listening to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from Vancouver on the unceded territory of the Hunkin Medium speaking Musqueam people. In the studio, I am joined by my collective teammate, Allison.
Hi.
Who is handling the switchboards for us today. In honor of Pride Month in Vancouver, today's episode will focus on the interviews Allison had the opportunity to do. But first, what does the province of BC do? There's a Pride festival that occurs each year on the first week or so of August, and the Vancouver Pride Parade takes place on Sunday, which is the second to the last day of the festival. One of those events in Vancouver's West End, especially along Davie Street, is famous for its rainbow colors and gay-friendly atmosphere any time of the year. But especially in late July and early August, when Vancouver's annual Gay Pride festivals take place. Furthermore, hosted by the Vancouver Pride Society, the events are celebrated not only by Vancouver's LGBTQ+ community, but by the entire city and visitors from around the world. These events are one of the city's most impressive annual parades, with the enjoyment of great music, rainbow colors, festive atmosphere, and crazy costumes. Even Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has joined in recent years to show his support. We will have more discussions on Pride Month and more, but first, we have our first song break. And Allison, would you like to introduce our first song, please?
Sure. Here's the local band, The Devours, with the song 21st and Main. And welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR FM 101.9. The song you just heard was 21st in Maine by Devours. Now you will hear an interview I had the opportunity to do, and that was with Robert James O'Brien. Robert is an author for Just One More Drive, the true story of a stuttering homosexual and his race car. I talked to him about his book, Pride Month, and more. It was a lot of fun. I hope you guys like it. Yeah. So hopefully you'll be all good.
Enjoy the interview, everyone.
Once I find it.
Ooh, okay. So my name is Robert O'Brien. I'm 41 years old. I'm originally from Dublin in Ireland, and I've been living in Canada for the last 10 years. I became a citizen last year, which was really exciting. So I work in the city here as an ESL teacher. So I teach English to foreign people. And I also am an author. I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Just One More Drive, The True Story of a Stuttering Homosexual and His Race Car. I have a stutter, and I spent a lot of my youth looking at how to deal with it and how to fix it. And I was also gay, homosexual, so I came out late in life. And I decided to write a book and just share that whole journey with people, and that's how I met yourself last week, and that's me.
Awesome. You tried speech therapy. Did it help? If not, why not?
I found it did certainly help. I kind of had two phases of speech therapy. When I was very young, when I began to stutter in school at a very young age, 8 and 9 years old, I was sent to state-run speech therapy, which was, you know, back in the day, the focus there was to manage your speech and control your speech and really try to fix your speech. And I spent a couple of months with a very nice, very knowledgeable speech therapist. Her name was Rita, I believe. And the therapy really focused on slowing down my speech and stretching out words and sounds. And that, you know, helped. That certainly helped. What happened was as I got older, I didn't qualify for speech therapy anymore. And as I got older, after about a year of, you know, pretty consistent speech, my stutter began to re-emerge when I went into secondary school. And I really didn't do anything in the space of speech therapy then until I was about 24, 25 years old. After I'd graduated in university, my speech had degraded to such a point that I wasn't able to speak on the phone. I wasn't very effective giving presentations. In fact, I hadn't given a presentation. And what had actually happened over the course of a week, three very separate people in my life had given me a newspaper article about a course. It was run by recovering stutterers for recovering stutterers, and it was called the Maguire program, and I went on my first course when I was about 25, and that was also around managing speech. They focus on a deep costal breathing method, which was another way of controlling it, but what I found really helpful about that speech therapy was it was run by recovering stutterers. So everybody in the room had a stutter. And so even if there were different flavors of stutter, everybody knew where people were coming from. And that really helped. And the biggest support I found there was just having a tribe, finding a tribe of people like myself. And I stayed on the course for about six or seven years. I moved up the ranks. I was a speech coach, and I got as far as course instructor intern before deciding to come to Canada and go to acting school.
Awesome. Hmm. So tell us more about growing up and what your life was like for you when you were in Ireland.
Life was, on the surface, it would have looked fairly normal. I would have looked fairly okay. As a stutterer, I'm what's called a covert stutterer, so I can hide it most of the time. If I'm caught in a stressful situation, I may stutter. As you heard a few minutes ago, I stuttered on the name of the course I did. You know, that can happen. But overall, I was able to hide it. And that's what I did growing up in school and later in college. I felt a lot of shame and a lot of fear around having a stutter. And one of the most common misconceptions is that stuttering is a fear of speaking. Now, it's not. It's a fear of stuttering while speaking. And for myself, I had been bullied when I was younger, and I often believe that led to the stutter developing, because there was a lot of fear around speaking and saying the right thing. And growing up was a pretty lonely time, Alison, to be honest. Like, that's really the word I would put to it. Like, it appeared fine. I would smile. I would be quiet and shy. But really, deep down, I was very scared, and I felt very much alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people feel were bullied, and that causes a lot of stuff.
Absolutely.
When did you realize you were gay?
Well, that's actually the kind of kicker. I kind of realized I was gay at the same age. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I shared the whole story. I was a huge science fiction fan, and I was watching an old episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th century, and there was an episode where Buck lost his shirt. And, you know, I was just glued to him, as opposed to the very sexy space princess he was saving. And, you know, at the time, I didn't actually have the word gay. I didn't know what gay meant, but it was a very similar feeling to the feeling I felt after I had been bullied. It was a very visceral fear. It was this is a bad thing to feel. If someone sees that you feel this way, you will be at risk. You will be hurt. So you have to kind of hide it. And as I got older and I learned more about what being gay meant, I really tried to hide it further, because this was, you know, 25, 30 years ago, when even though homosexuality was legal, it wasn't necessarily as accepted. And I had this whole vision of dealing with my speech first. I figured if I was a fluent speaker and I could fix my stutter, then I could deal with being gay. But they're both very, I mean, one of the funniest things, and I think one of the areas that you know, people are beginning to look at now in terms of having a stutter and being gay, the actual emotions associated are quite similar. So when I'm coming out, or when I was coming out as being a recovering stutterer, so I was, you know, trained to go out and make disclosures to people, to be honest and say, I have a stutter, this is how I sound, and I'm working on my speech. And those kind of emotions of fear and apprehension and slight giddiness, it feels very similar to coming out as gay. When you tell someone that you are gay, it's that same kind of feeling. And it's been kind of curious, you know, looking at how they both overlapped as I was growing up. And I felt more at ease with being gay. On some level, that felt more right, whereas having a stutter, I was very focused on being fixed or learning how to control it. And if I could control it, then things would happen in my life. So that's where my mind was at the time. I've learned since that there is nothing to fix, and you know, by being honest and owning it. I think being honest about it is the first step towards ownership, and that leads to freedom as a result.
Yeah. How did you tell your family members, and what were their reactions when you told them?
Yeah. Well, what had happened? So, as I said, I'd come over here to Vancouver to go to acting school. I was in my early 30s. I was 31 at the time. And looking back, you know, I had spent a lot of time in speech therapy, and I also knew I was gay, and I also knew that I would have to deal with it. I would have to either come out at some point or stay in the closet. So leaving home and coming over here gave me a lot of space. And in the setting of acting school, you know, running away from it was, you know, how it began. And then as the whole training and getting deeper into emotions and feelings came into our classes, I began to realize that if I'm not honest about this part of my life and part of my personality, I would never be free from it. So I went back home after the 6-month acting course finished, and I was very focused. I was very focused on just spending two or three weeks coming out face to face with the people who I felt were both the closest to me and the people who deserved to hear it. So my mom and dad were the first. I got back home. I flew home. I got off the plane, jumped in a cab, went home. And I just said, right, mom, dad, as I put my case down, I said, listen, I've got something to say. I need to say it now, because if I don't, I may not say it. I'm gay. And they weren't shocked. Everyone actually had figured it out a long time before I had figured it out. I think mother and father both felt sorry for the amount of time I had hidden it. They felt, you know, I had probably struggled a lot where I didn't need to. But I mean, overall, I spent about two or three weeks coming out. Everyone was fine. Everyone guessed. I had actually felt pretty mad about it, because every time I came out to someone and they kind of smirked and went, yeah, all of us guessed, or yeah, that's fine. It was like, whoa, hang on a second. This is major. I'm gay. I'm homosexual. You know, and they went, yeah, we, you know, all got what that means. So it was very easy. I had a very easy time of it. Everyone was accepting. And it was then only after that, coming out at a later age, I was 32. So I had to do a lot of learning in a very short amount of time.
Wow. It must have been really nice to be able to say that.
Yeah. I think, you know, as you asked me earlier, having a stutter and being gay, there's a lot of weight. There's a heavy sort of emotional weight that you sort of carry on your back. And even though I wouldn't have necessarily chosen either of them, being able to say it and own it, yeah, it really did feel amazing. And it, you know, also allowed me to, you know, open up in a sort of authentic way that I wouldn't have been able to in the past.
Yeah. So you wrote a book called Just One More Drive, The True mm-hmm. Story of a Stuttering Homosexual and His Race Car.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how it came about and what made you want to write a book?
I can, and I don't really want to put in a lot of spoilers, so I'm always cautious in how I share that. But how I began to write the book, it was a situation when I was 35, and I'd hit rock bottom in my life, and this was after I had come out as gay, and it was after I'd spent many years on speech therapy, and I had thought, by being honest and doing all of this, that things would begin to happen in my life. And that wasn't the case. I went like to a, you know, a fairly dark space, you know, took actions I'm not necessarily proud of. And after the actions had failed, I kind of thought, right, what do I do now? And I never actually planned on writing a book per se. I figured if I went back and began writing about my whole life. I would figure out some form of missing, like, sort of notes, missing events that maybe I wasn't seeing that I needed to still see to fix things. It evolved. The book itself evolved from a very private, personal diary and self-exploration exercise to a book. And that took about two or three years to reach that point. I kept on writing, and eventually I had sort of gone back to my very early childhood and was up to the current time, and I had enough to actually have a book. And that's where it actually came from originally.
Wow. How long did it take to write this book?
I think it took probably about three or four years. Writing the first version of the book happened over 6 or 7 months. And then I found, I got in touch with a copy editor friend here, and then she had a look at it, sent it back, you know, with her notes. And then, you know, it became a kind of process of back and forth, editing, copy editing, taking bits out, adding bits in. When it had been gone over a couple of times, then I got in touch with a friend of a friend who knew someone who wrote a book. So it was a very kind of step-by-step process. But the hardest thing was having to kind of take it back every single time. And I think towards the end of the process, in the third or the fourth year, I was finding it very hard taking it back, because I'd gone over it so many times. It was like, look, I'm really getting very close to the you know end of my rag with this book, and can someone else take it, and can someone else finish it? But of course they couldn't. But it took, I think, probably about three or four years from actual start to the finished book and the first printed batches.
Awesome.
Mm.
So now that you've finished and published the book, what are you doing now?
Well, that's the thing. I thought finishing the book and having it finished, once it was finished, things would just happen. And I'm kind of sitting back laughing, thinking, this is how I thought life would happen all of the time. Once you take one action, things happen. And finishing the book, launching the book was really awesome. I didn't think it would ever happen. So to have the book launch, to actually have the physical book, to have a website has been really amazing. And what I've discovered from doing that, it's not actually about me and a book, because I've been, you know, really looking at how to take the next step with it. So at the moment, it's like sort of doing, media things, whether it's on, radio, whether it's giving workshops. I just gave my first workshop with my father last month as part of the National Stammering Association, which was the first actual workshop I gave. And what I'm trying to really do now, and the whole point of the book, is to really share it and to kind of help, people who are maybe in their kind of teens, and they're kind of dealing with like things, whether it's being gay, whether it's being, anything, you know, everyone has their own issue. Everyone has their own flavor to it. And what I'm really looking at doing is just kind of sharing my own story, in the hopes that it actually helps. Other people laugh, helps other people see that, you know, everyone's dealing with their own thing. And, you know, going back to the whole message of the book and being honest, you know, being able to say I'm a stuttering homosexual, I've had people laugh, I've had other people, say, really, that's what you think of yourself. But to me, it's to have that space to be able to say, this is me, this is the, you know, path I've been on, and there's nothing wrong and there's nothing to fix. And I think that's really the biggest biggest sort of thing, and that's the, you know, that's really what I'm out to share. You know, there is nothing to fix, and it's very easy to kind of step back and say, well, I'm single because of my stutter. I'm not successful because of my stutter. I'm alone because I'm gay. And it's, you know, it's really easy to kind of, I mean, blame or to focus on the things that we don't have. And, you know, you can spend a lot of time trying to fix it. You can spend a lot of time listening to what everyone else thinks. And the whole exercise of having to write a book, having to own the book, pitch the book, sell the book, and now share the book, it's really forced me to have to keep digging and seeing that everything I thought wasn't necessarily right. And by sharing it, that's, you know, what I can do. And I actually like doing it because I thought I was the only person out there dealing with his things, and everyone is dealing, and we're all dealing. And by sharing it, we actually begin to kind of lift that heavy weight off it, and we have an opportunity to just, I mean, be, and to maybe laugh at it. Like, I mean, I, you know, do also find it quite funny that as someone who has a stutter, discovering that I actually like doing, I mean, radio bits, doing workshops, going to acting school, like, it's actually quite funny in a, you know, sort of dark humor kind of way. But really what I'm out to cause is to just share it and to, you know, help, to be of service ultimately.
Awesome. So have you had any feedback on your book from your family, friends, and the readers?
I've, like, not a huge amount. People have read the book. The people closest to me, I think, you know, haven't said a lot about the book, and I fully get it. It's like all very close to home. In terms of book like sales and stuff, I'm still working on actually getting the book out there. So I haven't had a huge number of people buying and reading the book. So I haven't had that opportunity to really get feedback. But I mean, people have said, I mean, you know, various things. It's, I mean, funnier than they thought it'd be. Because when I was writing it, I didn't want it to be a, you know, sort of overly dark book. I didn't want it to be very, very dark. So I do write with a lot of humor, or what I think and what my editor thought was humorous. People have said that it's an easier book to read than they thought it'd be. People have had a lot of fun with it. Given that it's, you know, dealing with various issues, cars, being gay, having a stutter, people, I've found certain people get more from certain parts of it. But I mean, no one has, like, you know, I mean, said, Robert, this is the worst book ever, and you really shouldn't put it out in the world. So I, you know, haven't heard anything super, super negative about it yet.
What advice would you give for people with disabilities who may be in similar situations that you were in, or how to confront or be open that they are gay, queer, or lesbian?
I think the first thing, let me just take a pause and just make sure this is clear. Yeah, I think the first thing for myself is what I'd say is there's a, you know, level of having to accept it on a personal level first, you know, to kind of say, right, this is what I've got, whether it's a physical disability or a, you know, speech disability. But the most important thing is to really share it, find others who are dealing with the same thing, and even if it's the scariest thing ever, reaching out, sending that first, I mean, mail, sending making that first phone call, asking someone who may be able to help. Reaching out is the biggest thing, and it's the scariest step, because once you begin to reach out, there isn't any turning back. But I think reaching out, finding people who are dealing with the same thing, because the biggest biggest issue, I think, is people think they're, you know, they're the only ones dealing with it. And then after you find others who are dealing with the same thing, you then have space to actually share it, to speak about it, to own it, and then, you know, see what the next step is. I myself, as I said, I, you know, sort of used a lot of this to, you know, I would use having a stutter to, you know, sort of blame why I wasn't where I thought I would be, or, you know, being gay meant I could have this but I couldn't have that. And I think it's very easy to get stuck in that mindset and you know, playing the victim, essentially. And that's very easy. It's, you know, it's a nice space, but it's not the most authentic. And if you really want to live a full life, I think owning it, sharing it, and learning how to be the best version of yourself with it. Because even though people say warts and all, I've begun to really see that it's the warts that make us us. It's what makes us, I mean, it's what makes us special. It gives us a special way of seeing things, and there's a huge amount of opportunities. So definitely share us, take that first leap of faith, and you aren't alone. And there also isn't anything to fix. You know, this is what, you know, this is what people have, this is what you have. It's not to fix it, it's to own it, it's to accept it, it's to make, I mean, peace with it and live the fullest life you can live.
Yeah. So Pride Month is near us. Can you tell us what this month means to you and others and why it is important?
I think Pride Month for myself, I'm not the kind of biggest, I mean, party animal. So like the whole getting sort of dressed up and having fun is not necessarily what I do myself first. But that being said, I think Pride to be, I mean, seen. That's the first thing, to actually be able to be seen as gay. I mean, queer. You know, wherever you fall, to be able to be seen and to be able to be, I mean, proud of it and to own it fully. Pride to me at this point is really, you know, where the, you know, older men and women who really fought, people who fought and, I mean, died for my, I mean, freedom to be gay and to be able to be gay, I think is one of the biggest things, or one of the biggest reasons Pride is still as relevant as it is. I think it's the fact that, you know, others fought for that right, and it's a gift to us now to be able to actually be ourselves, and to be seen. And, you know, to also be fully accepted, I think, too.
Yeah. Will you be at the Pride Parade on Sunday?
I think so. I'm not sure exactly where or what I'll be doing, but yeah, I think I'll be there. I think I'll be meeting a couple of friends, maybe having some food and watching it.
Nice.
As it happens.
It'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Besides writing a book, what else have you done in terms of bringing awareness on disability?
I suppose just being in a space where I've become less self-conscious about having a stutter. And if I do stutter, I can now own it. And that's not to say that having a stutter is necessarily a disability, but I think in just showing it and being at ease with it and not making it a big deal, I've been more open and not as focused on trying to hide it, because I can't hide it all of the time. And you know, also putting a face to it. When I was looking at speech therapy or when I was a lot younger, and I, you know, my experience was I'm the only one who has this. So by also reaching out to other groups and by being part of other groups, I think it's putting a face on, you know, whatever issue or disability that you're dealing with.
Yeah. Yeah. So you also like cars.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any cars in particular that you love?
Yeah, cars I love. I mean, cars, because as a kid I felt safe in a car, and my father was a car guy, so he was a, you know, sort of German car fan. So I am a little bit, I mean, biased. Any sort of German make of car, I would sort of lean towards more than anything else. Minis. I'm a, you know, huge fan of the first gen BM Mini. I was a huge BMW fan back in the day. Not as much now, since they're kind of building bigger cars and front wheel drive cars. I often feel they've lost a little bit of their focus. If I could buy any car at the moment, any sort of German car, it would probably have a Porsche badge on its snout. Because they're just, you know, I mean, pure race cars still. And I think Porsche have been able to actually, you know, keep on building hardcore sports cars, even though they're also selling very, very big SUV models, which are, you know, kind of still sporty enough to warrant having the Porsche badge on their snout.
Yeah. What is it like to be a proud gay and a proud person with a disability in the racing industry?
I don't know. I would like to think that it doesn't really matter at this point. If you're someone who's in the field, then your knowledge or your skill should be the main focus. So I don't really think it's a huge deal. I think being open and honest about it first does, I mean, it certainly helps, because then, you know, if it's, you know, out there in the open, then it won't ever become a big issue, where I think if you are hiding it, it has the potential to be an issue.
Yeah. Last but not least, is there anything you would like to say to the CITR listeners?
I've really begun to learn that there isn't anything to fix. And as I get older, I care less about what, you know, people think. And that's really a gift too. You know, life is to be lived. And it's more fun than I ever thought it could be, with or without a disability. You know, it just is. And by really owning it, you can make, you know, you can really have an awesome life. And I can't, like growing up when I was 6 or 7 or even at 12 or 17, I wouldn't have ever thought that. I still would have thought, no, I have to be fixed, or I need to hide this before I can start living. Where you just live, you know, you just go on out there and have fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
And hello, everyone. This is DP, and welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. That was an interview Allison conducted with Robert James O'Brien, who is an author of Just One More Drive, The True Story of Stuttering Homosexual and His Race Car. Thanks, Robert, for chatting with Allison. And now we're going to a song break. This song is Sad Femme Club with Kim Mortal. So, Allison?
Yeah, hope you'll enjoy it.
Dear goddess, give me patience, tired of trying to explain. I've got zero tolerance when they with my sacred space. Bar the trolls, hit the corners for escape. Build the platforms, take up space. Cold the scripts to infiltrate. Cause you're never not fighting a racist system that keeps powers in place and that fails to acknowledge the root of your pain. Took it too personal, over emotional. Where are you from? Are you beauty or brains? Over the top, I'm too little or too much. If I do and I'm if I do not. Talking class, race, and the sex intersections. My feelings are valid and I won't dismiss them. I was taught not to trust my own mind and decisions. My body is my body, I won't give them an apology. Indoctrinated habits, like smile, nod your head, I'll talk less, close my legs. What? That's exactly what I just said. Are you serious? If I lose my right now, will I just be dismissed right now? If I lose my right now, will I just be dismissed right now? Will I just be dismissed? Welcome to the Sad Fam Club, baby. You are enough. Hey, 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 hey. Welcome to the Sad Fam Club, baby. You are enough. Hey, 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 hey. Toxic masculinity is killing all the poetry. Hold my brothers back from free, flowing with the sea. Our tears like the holy ink to sink a patriarchy. Popping egos like balloons, cause we don't exist for you. Burn your eyes with tiger bombs, don't try to tell her to be calm. Colonial repercussions, any questions? CC the boss, she's the boss. Expert of self, they pray the moon. She raps and spells, I'm attuned to what you're numb to. Check my mood ring, did I ask you? No, I prefer my make-believe to their bull. I work within it, but at the end of shift, I build spectrums on the internet. I art attack cause I'm an empath. Foundations, Philippinex. No limits on how I choose to express. With my pixels and my queerness, you can't hold me back. If I lose my right now, will I just be dismissed right now? If I lose my right now, will I just be dismissed right now? Will I just be dismissed? Welcome to the Sad Fam Club, baby. You are enough. Hey!
And we're back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. That was Kim Mortal with Sad Fem Club, and she is a local artist, which is awesome. And she is also queer, which is perfect.
Yeah.
Next, we will hear an interview that I did with Andrew Gerza, who is a disability awareness consultant and a crimple content creator. In his work, he sees to explore how the lived experience of disability feels as it interplays with intersectional communities. By using hashtags like disabled, disability after dark, barren in a chair, and kiss a queer cripple, Andrew shares his lived experiences of disability, queerness, sexuality, and body image in a raw, vulnerable, and unapologetic fashion, So here's Andrew. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Andrew Groza. I am a disability awareness consultant. I work primarily in queerness, sexuality, and disability. I'm 35 years old. I live in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm a wheelchair user, and I have cerebral palsy.
Awesome. Why did you start the hashtag disabled people are hot?
That's a great question. I started the hashtag, actually. The origin story of that hashtag was I was bored one day on Twitter. And I just I put disabled people are hot, not as a hashtag, just as like a sentence in my Twitter one day. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to go over to Twitter's like search bar and put in the hashtag and see if somebody has used it before. And I came back with no one's ever used this hashtag before. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. So I realized that I had an opportunity to use this hashtag to do something really cool. So I put the hashtag in and I said, if anybody with disabilities wants to use this hashtag and post a picture of themselves where they feel good about themselves or happy or sexy, put a photo in. And I didn't think it would blow up. And I did this around 9 or 10 o'clock that night. Right before I went to bed. And then I went to bed and I woke up and I had like 20,000 tweets.
Wow.
It was pretty awesome.
That must have been. Can you tell us some past projects and advocating work you have done on creating inclusive space for queers with disabilities?
Sure. I co-hosted one of the first sex play parties for disabled people in the world in Toronto back in 2015. I have consistently advocated on social media for queer spaces to become accessible. I've participated in marches talking about accessibility and queer advocacy, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. What, in your opinion, how can we make queer spaces better accessible for those with disabilities?
The first thing we have to do is to listen to disabled people and hire disabled people when we are building these establishments or when we're renovating these establishments. We need to with the disabled community to ensure that it's as accessible as possible. And I don't just mean in terms of physical accessibility for a wheelchair user. I'm talking about things like for somebody who may also have things like anxiety, stuff like that. How do we make those spaces more accessible and welcoming? And we really need to use disabled people who are queer to sit with these establishments and train them on what being disabled feels like and how we can use these spaces to create community as opposed to keeping people out.
Right. What kind of role do support workers have in their clients' participation in Pride?
What kind of rules do they have? I don't think in the organization where I live, there's nothing related to Pride there. When I was in Toronto's Pride last year, I didn't see any disability-centric organizations being represented. So I don't think there are a lot of regulations around which disability organizations can be a part of Pride, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. When did you realize you were queer?
That's a great question. I discovered that I liked boys when I was about 5 or 6. I came out as gay at 15. And I really just kind of came out as queer probably when I was about 27, 28. Because I realized that gay, in my experience as a male-identified person with a penis, I realized that gay doesn't fit my aesthetic, doesn't fit who I am, because I can't conform to the really high body aesthetic that a lot of gay males are subjected to when they're trying to come out and all these things. I can't go to the gym. I can't have a body that is, you know, perfectly sculpted because of disability. So queer really feels like a nice, safe terminology that says, oh, yeah, I like, you know, people of my gender, no, my sex, rather, but I use gay and queer interchangeably depending on the company that I'm with. But for me, queer feels, and it also feels radical. It also feels like if I say queer, it also lends itself to being able to talk about disability more readily, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah. How did your family and your friends react to when you told them that you were queer?
My mom is really supportive. She's like my champion. So she, when I came out as gay at first when I was 15, we rented Priscilla, Queen of the Desert together, and we watched that together. So she was very supportive. My friends, again, very supportive. I was very privileged and lucky in that way that I never really had to deal with a lot of backlash. But I do think there are some people in the disabled community who are uncomfortable with the idea of disabled people being queer.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Yeah, and it's just unfortunate. It's just really, it's just sad. I'm saddened that in our community we have disabled people who aren't accepting of other disabled. I think it's unfortunate. When I was in college, I there was another disabled guy in college with me, and I remember him saying, "You're not gay. You don't really like. You're not gay. We'll find you a girlfriend. Don't worry about it." And just felt. I remember just feeling very kind of saddened by that, because disabled people are asking people to accept us for being disabled. Why can't disabled people accept people for being queer?
Yeah. What advice would you give people with disabilities who may be in a similar situation than you are in on how to confront or be open that they are gay, queer, or lesbian?
I think that's a tough question, because so many of us with disabilities are using services like home care or attendant care. Where if they come out, they could lose their housing or their security or that kind of stuff, or they don't want to bring the burden, the quote unquote burden of queerness to their family. So I would say do what is right for you. There's no handbook on how to do this, and there's no right or wrong way to do it. If coming out feels okay for you, do that. If for your safety as a disabled person, you feel it's safer for you to stay in the closet, do that.
Yeah. So in Vancouver, we have Pride Month coming up in August.
Yeah, that's right.
What does the Pride Month or Pride Parade mean to you?
I'm not a fan of the crowds. To be honest, I don't do the parade a lot in Toronto. I don't do it often because it's just a lot of people and there's not a lot of accessibility. I think I would love to see more disabled people in the parade being celebrated. I don't know how we do it in Vancouver, but if it's similar to Toronto, there's not a lot of disabled people that we see in the parade. I would love to see more of that represented. I would love to see more disabled people being sexualized positively in the way that they want to. Body positivity around the wheelchair users, different mobility users. I would love to see access to the parade made more accessible, like more ways to get around people, more designated spots for people to go if they want to watch the parade. I would love attendant care to be something that is built into the parade, so that if somebody needs to pee and they didn't bring a person with them, there's somebody available for them, stuff like that. Really just logistical stuff to make the parade more accessible.
Yeah. Why do you think Pride Month is so important?
because we need to talk about this stuff. Being, I think it's important because when these months come around, we get to celebrate who we are. And I think if you are doubly marginalized, like in my case, queer and disabled, it's a great opportunity for these two identities to crash together in a really cool way. So I think I just think it's important, and I don't think that there should be months ascribed to these things. I think they're important for recognition for like certain things, but I also think we should be trying to strive for this stuff every day.
Yeah. Do you think that society is getting better at accepting gay, queer, and or lesbian people? Why are and why not?
Again, loaded question, because in certain communities I would say yes, and in other communities I would definitely not say yes. I think that the disability community has a lot of work to do when it comes to accepting LGBTQ people and trans people and all that stuff. I think we have a lot of work to do. I think we're getting better, but I also think I do have an issue with how inaccessible the LGBTQ community is to a lot of disabled people, and I just think we need to do more work with that. I think we're getting better in spots, but I can't access, like, it's not just the parade I want to access on Pride. I want to also go to the bars. I want to go party. I want to go get laid at the bars that I want to. Like, there's a whole sexual aspect to Pride that queer and disabled people are often forced to miss out on, and that's not fair.
Yeah. You're a very busy person because you host a podcast called Disability After Dark. Can you tell how that started and what some topics you cover?
Sure. That started in September of 2016. So, wow, almost 3 years now. Holy goodness. And then it started because I did a lot of writing for places like HuffPost and other establishments, and I was like, I wonder if I can turn this into a podcast, because as somebody with severe CP, typing on a computer wasn't always easy for me and was really hard to do sometimes and hurt my hand. So I was like, I don't want to type all this stuff out. I want to talk it out. And I was like, well, what if I just did a podcast? And I had no idea how to do a podcast. So I started looking up, like, I looked up other podcasts to see if there was a sex and disability podcast out there. And to my luck, there wasn't. And I was like, okay, I'm going to just put one out and see what happens. And at this point, I had no, like, recording equipment. I had nothing professional. It was literally me, my Mac, and some headphones, and an idea. I mean, being like, hi, my name's Andrew. I'm going to do this. And it just kind of happened from there. But, yeah, and so I'm really proud of it because it's the only sexuality and disability-based podcast that's really taken off in the last couple of years. There are a few out there that were there for a while but then had to go away for a bit. So I'm just really proud of it because it's one of a kind. I'm also really proud of it because it touches on topics not just about sex but about the disability lived experience. So things like, how do you go on a date when you can't use a car? How do you date if you have this kind of disability? How do you have sex if your disability is like this? And so I really try to go in depth to all the stuff we don't talk about around sex and disability.
Yeah. Are there any other projects you are working on right now that you can tell us?
Sure, I sure can. There's one that I definitely want to share with you. My sister and I are working on a project called Deliciously Disabled, which will eventually be a brand around celebrating disability. And we're also starting by designing and creating the first line of sex toys for people with disabilities by disabled people. So we're trying to make sex toys for and by disabled people. So we're working on that. We're currently looking for donations to get our research funded. If people want to donate to us, they can head over to deliciouslydisabled.ca and click on the donate button, and they can go to our GoFundMe page there and see exactly what we're doing. So we're working on that. We're also just working on building a lifestyle brand around disability, around this idea of what it means to be deliciously disabled.
Awesome. Now, last but not least, is there anything you would like to say to the CITR listeners?
Sure. I want to say thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure. And if anybody with a disability listening wants to come on my show, Disability After Dark, they can hit me up on the social media. All my social media is the Andrew Gurza, so TheAndrewGurza on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So I'd love to invite the listeners to come on the show and talk to me about disability, talk to me about sexuality. I just want to thank everybody for having me, because it's such a pleasure to go to talk on the West Coast about this stuff.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we are back. The voice you just heard was from Andrew Gurza, an advocate for disability rights and disability and sexuality, to name a few. This also wraps up our show for today. Hope you all enjoyed the interviews and today's show. If you would like to know more about All Access Pass, you can email us at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Thank you for listening today as well. Also, thank you to Robert James O'Brien and Andrew Gurza for talking to me. Please like our All Access Facebook page. We would like to more likes on that page.
Yes, we do. And if you're on Twitter or Instagram or both, please follow All Access Pass at @access_CITR and message anytime if you want to get involved with the Accessibility Collective. That's @access_CITR. And if you miss part of our live show today and want to listen again, or even maybe you want to listen to our past shows, you can by going on to citr.ca and click on the search box and search All Access Pass.
Stick around for more CITR programming coming up next, and we will be back August 21st.
Yeah.
Which will be fun. Hi, yeah. Grandpa.
Yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
And to end off the show, I'm going to play Find You from Charlotte Day Wilson, who's another queer Canadian. Hope you enjoy.
Bye, everyone.
To get to you, but it's me I was looking for. anxiety. Swallow up the sands that hide you. Now that I can see, I can find you. Follow everything's right beside you. Now that I can breathe, I can sigh to you. Swallow up the sands that hide you.
Hey, this is Taylor Morey from Deadweight Citizens Brigade, and you are listening to CITR FM 101.9, Vancouver's home of rock and roll.